Welcome back, friends. So glad you could join us. We continue our discussion of the documents of Vatican II. In today's episode, we're going to discuss the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world, Gaudium et Spes. That Latin title, Gaudium et Spes, means joy and hope. And that's how the document begins. The joy and hope, the grief and anguish of the men of our time, especially of those who are poor or afflicted in any way, are the joy and hope, the grief and anguish of the followers of Christ as well. Nothing that is genuinely human fails to find an echo in their hearts. For theirs is a community composed of men who, united in Christ and guided by the Holy Spirit, press onwards towards the kingdom of the Father and are bearers of a message of salvation intended for all men. In other words, what this document is saying from the Council Fathers is that we belong to the human race, the family of man. We're all made in the image and likeness of God. Regardless of what religion, what creed, what race, what culture, we are all of the human race, the brotherhood of man, men and women of every race and nation. Therefore, we have an obligation, a duty to our brothers and sisters all over the world. And this document, this pastoral constitution of the church in the modern world, wants us to know that there is joy and hope. Now recall, this document is written in 1965. It's in the midst of some turmoil. There's a cultural revolution going on in the United States. We just survived the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's trouble brewing all over the world between communism. There's conflict in Asia and Africa. Europe, there's a decline, as there is in the United States, of moral standards. Young people are wondering, what's the use of authority? Why should we obey any moral laws? People are sitting out of school, going on strike, burning flags, draft cards. There's tension between peoples of different races within the urban cities. All this is going on, and yet the council says there's joy and hope. Why? Because not only is there joy and hope when we're having good days, but we also share in each other's sufferings. So if there's someone who is suffering because they're poor, if somebody is suffering because they're sick, if somebody's suffering because they're a victim of prejudice or racism, we suffer too. And if we realize that we suffer with them, then we also will share their joys, they will share ours. The council addresses, therefore, everybody. And here we're told in paragraph 2, now the Second Vatican Council has deeply studied the mystery of the Church. We looked at Lumen Gentium. It resolutely addresses not only the sons of the Church, that is, those of us who are Catholic Christians, and all who call upon the name of Christ, all Christians, but the whole of humanity as well. And it longs to set forth the way it understands the presence and function of the Church in the world today. Whereas Lumen Gentium looked at the nature of the Church in herself, the theology of the Church, Gaudium et Spes wants to look at what does the Church do now? What's her goal, her mission, her role as evangelist, as apostle? We're asked to offer a service to all mankind. Yes, the Church's primary duty and function is to provide for the sacramental and spiritual needs of her children, but also to see the needs of everybody as somewhat being her concern too. That's why the Holy Father, when he makes all these wonderful pastoral visits all over the world, what does he do? He talks to leaders not just of the Christian world, but of the Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist world, and says to them, justice is something that is entitled to everyone. So he challenges the political leaders of everywhere, of every nation, that they should strive for justice. He asks that they respect the dignity of the human person from the moment of conception to the last breath of old age. He tells leaders of the world, whether it's the first, second, or third world, whether it's the capitalist, the communist, the socialist, he tells people of the northern or southern hemispheres, of the east or west, that mankind belongs to the same family, the family of God, that we're all made in the image and likeness of God, that we have a human dignity that merits respect, that we have inalienable rights from our Creator that are not given by the state, not given by a constitution, but are given to us by God in our human personhood. But what does the document also tell us? It tells us what the present situation is. There's both hope and anguish, we're told in the introduction. There's hope, why? Because there's so many people of goodwill. There's the Christian message, which still needs to be preached. But there's also anguish. Why? Because there's still sin in the world. People still are greedy, lustful, angry. All the seven deadly sins that we know too well and practice too often, they are rampant. And when we focus on the self, the ego, rather than on the community of believers, the community of man, on the family, first of all, the natural family, mother, father, husband, wife who have children, and then the larger family, the spiritual family, the parish, the church, and then the social family, our neighborhood, our community, that we just don't live in our house isolated from everyone else, but we live with other people. Man is a social being. And so the Gaudium et Spes, the church fathers, want to remind us of our intimate connection to other people. There have been changes in the social order, and we know this all too well, but especially in 1965, there was great upheaval, as we already mentioned. So paragraph 6 tells us, as a result of the traditional structure of local communities, family, clan, tribe, village, various groupings and social relationships, is subjected to ever more sweeping changes. We had the Industrial Revolution in the last century, where business, industry, changed quite a bit of structure in our life. How many people went to work at a very early age, 14 years old? How many men died in the mines digging for coal or in the steel mills? How many women had to go to the sweatshops? When the assembly line was first created, it enabled so many products to be made cheaply and efficiently, but it also allowed many people to become just a number, just another worker. There's imbalance of the world today. On the family level, there are tensions arising from the demographic, economic, and social pressure, out of conflicts between succeeding generations, out of new and social relationships between the sexes. Paragraph 8. In the world, there's turmoil going on because you've got people who are becoming richer and richer, and yet there's other people becoming poorer and poorer. Nations, not just people, entire nations are getting further and further into debt, whereas some nations are getting more and more richer and powerful. There's also people's rights being violated. Totalitarian governments and regimes, whether it's fascism or communism, whether it's the dictator of one country or it's the whole culture of one particular government, to outlaw religion or the free practice thereof. But even at the more local level, families are being torn apart. Now, we live in this new century, the 21st century, and yet we can recall back in the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, as well as the 60s, the family was being torn apart. The rampant divorce rate, the illegitimacy, abortion, contraception, all these things have contributed, as well as the poverty, the racism, the injustices. The family has suffered so much that young men and women don't know who their mom or dad is. They don't spend time as a family either eating a meal or even worshiping God, praying together. These have all contributed to a turmoil in the world, not just globally, but especially locally. Paragraph 9 tells us, great numbers of people are acutely conscious of being deprived of the world's goods through injustice, unfair distribution, and vehemently demanding their share of them. What gives the impetus to some of these tyrants to take over? They promise people what they cannot give them. We look at the Marxist Revolution in Russia that occurred in 1917. What did Marx and Lenin, what did Stalin promise the people that they couldn't give them? Let's take all the property away from the Tsar and the nobility, and we'll give it over to you, and you'll be fine. We'll take what we need and give it to you. Well, they took, but they didn't give. They then imposed their rule over them. So they supplanted the tyranny of the Tsar with the tyranny of Stalin, who was more ruthless than people imagine. There are deeper questions that have to be asked, Gaudium et Spes tells us. There's a dichotomy in the world, a dichotomy not just between the rich and the poor, but in man himself, between good and evil, between the me and the thee. When I put myself first before you, Jesus did the opposite. He was the servant. Remember when he washed the feet of the apostles, he said, the first shall be last, the last shall be first. Take up your cross, follow me, follow the example of Christ. The world's telling us the opposite. Get what you can get, do what you have to do. Look out for number one. There is only one, and it's not me, it is the Lord. So this document tells us we have to look at what really gives us hope, the dignity of the human person. In paragraph 12, we're told that man is made in the image of God. Well, we know this from Genesis. We're made in the image and likeness of God. But God did not create us as a solitary being. Recall in Genesis, God created Adam. But what happened? Adam was not whole yet. He was not complete. So God created the animals to assist him, to comfort him. But it wasn't enough. When was Adam totally happy? When God created woman. When he created Eve. Another human person. See, that's how you and I are in the image and likeness of God. We are persons. God is three persons in one. The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You and I are human persons. We are not complete, we're not truly happy unless we are in relationship to other persons. Whether it's a human person or our total, absolute fulfillment when we're in relationship with the divine persons of God. Yet, paragraph 13 tells us, although set by God in a state of rectitude, man enticed by the evil one abused his freedom at the very start of history. Man therefore divided himself. Sin divides us. Remember, Jesus talks about a house that is divided will not stand. When they accuse him of being in league with Beelzebub, the devil, he says, now why would I do that? The devil will be fighting among himself. That doesn't make any sense. The devil's not going to hold for any division within his ranks. He's a good, evil general. He wants solidarity among his soldiers. And so too, on the spiritual plane of virtue, we need solidarity. And the devil knows that. So he divides and conquers within us and among each other. So sin divides, it corrodes. The essential nature of man is told to us in paragraph 14, that man, though made of body and soul, is a unity. The body and soul belong together. This is why when a person dies, we give them Christian burial. That's why when even somebody gets permission to be cremated, we don't throw the ashes up in the air or scatter them. They have to be buried with respect, because those ashes will be raised up on the last day. That body will be restored with the soul. The document therefore tells us, for this reason, man may not despise his body. Nevertheless, man has been wounded by sin. He finds the experience that his body is in revolt, in revolution. Yes, we think, oh, well, I just should appease my body, therefore every bodily whim and whimsy. No. Our body sometimes is in revolt against the higher virtues of the soul. The soul has the intellect, the will, the conscience. And so the spiritual faculties are always superior to the corporal elements. The soul is superior to the body, yet it's a cohesive union. Therefore, the soul does not resent the body. It's not like Plato that we're imprisoned souls. But as Aristotle pointed out in Thomas Aquinas, is a beautiful integral union. Therefore, I have to treat my body with respect. What do people do today? They indulge in drugs. They indulge in over-drinking. They engage in all kinds of immoral sexual activity, which not only threaten their body, but other people's. They treat someone who's just been conceived as if it were just bodily tissue that could be discarded. The body is sacred because it's connected to the soul, and the body and soul belong to the person. The document tells us that in paragraph 16, deep within his conscience, man discovers a law which he has not laid upon himself, but which he must obey, the natural moral law. In Pope John Paul's beautiful encyclical, Veritatis Splendor, the splendor of truth, he points this out beautifully, that the natural law is not something that confines us, that restricts us, but allows us to become more free. My freedom is the freedom to choose good, and the more good I choose to do, the more free I become, because then I can do more good, and I'm closer to the divine one. And God is totally, absolutely free, and yet he's also devoid of all sin. We think, well, if I'm free, I can choose to do whatever I want. you could say that the doctor could tell you, look, take this medicine, get so many hours of sleep, and you'll get better. And you could say, I'll do what I want. I'm not going to take these pills. I'm not going to get all these hours of rest. And what happens? You not only stay sick, you get worse. What did the doctor tell you? He gave you the choice. Oh, listen to him or her, follow the prescription, or suffer the consequences. We do the same with God. The document, therefore, gets more specific in the second part when it looks at specific problems of a global scale. The document looks at things like global hunger, the fact that so many nations are without and some have too much. Now, it's not advocating a socialist revolution. It's not advocating an embracement of communism. But at the same time, it's not endorsing unbridled capitalism. It's reminding us that we have a social responsibility to everybody. There's enough food to feed everyone in the world. We just have to find a way of distributing it. Yes, I'm allowed to own private property. My country's allowed to own things. And yet I can't ignore the people in other parts of the world any more than I can ignore people in my neighborhood. I can't take care of all their needs, but I must do what I can. The document talks to us about human activity, what we do with each other as individuals, but also as communities, as nations, that we are not looking for territory to seize. At Vatican II, they're just remembering the Cold War, the aftermath of World War II, the horrors that were done at that time, but also World War I, all the things that have been going on through the centuries, war, greed, crime, terrorism. And even in our own times, we see young people, children, shooting each other, committing despicable acts of violence. Where did these children learn that from? Us, the adults, from history, from watching things on TV. Who made this stuff? We did. This was not of God's making. So sin is rampant, and yet we still have joy and hope. Why? Because good people can get together and offer solutions. And this is what Gaudium et Spes reminds us. We need to form societies and unions. Now again, it's not that Gaudium et Spes says we must support 100% something like the UN, but that nations should get together and discuss their differences, that they should be able to talk things out before they resort to conflict, before they resort to dropping bombs. The document is very clear of the immorality of total war. And yet, in 1965, the United States and Russia subscribed to the Mutual Assured Destruction Act, MAD. And it was MAD. The idea was, if they bomb New York, we'll bomb Moscow. It had nothing to do with military strategy to target military installations, to wipe out the military structure, to get the soldiers, the missiles. The idea was, kill civilians and kill civilians. And this threat of killing innocent people would allegedly prevent war. The arms race was getting out of hand in 1965. Missile and missile and missile. New deployment means, whether it was airborne or from the sea or underground. And so the council was saying, we have to put a brake on this arms race. We have to be able to resolve these issues without leading to Armageddon. At the same time, it wasn't endorsing any particular political solution. It wasn't outlawing or saying it was immoral to have anti-ballistic missiles or a defense system. It wasn't saying that we needed to have unilateral disarmament, but it also said we had to work at peace. Peace was something that just isn't a fiction. It was something that needs to be worked at. The document also goes on to tell us that Jesus Christ is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. Well, we heard from John's Gospel, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, and the Word became flesh. Jesus came into human history, and he will return at the end of time. What will he find at the end of time? Will he find cities and countries that are trying to get to work out things together? Or is he going to find people who are now closing in on themselves? When even the family is being torn apart, what does he find among nations? He wants us to see that we are made in his image, his likeness. And no matter what country we belong to, no matter what language we speak, we belong to the same family of faith. We are made in God's image. The document also talks about the importance, obviously, of the family. Now, 1965, who would imagine what was going to happen in the year 2000, the way we have some of these bizarre family structures where there's one or two dads, one or two moms, or at least so-called. No one knows who's who. You watch on TV or you look in some of the newspapers, and when I'm having a wedding or a funeral, everybody's got different last names. You don't know who belongs to who. And yet, in 1965, they saw the beginnings of this. Why? Because divorce was beginning to increase. Contraception was allowing people to divorce, not just on the legal sense, but to divorce within themselves the sacredness of procreation within the unity. Love and life, unity and procreation were now being divorced because of the pill. So the document reminds us that marriage is sacred. It is so sacred in the eyes of God that Jesus loves the church as a husband loves his wife. And it's from marriage that we receive children, and from children comes society. Therefore, it behooves society, it behooves the world to do everything possible to protect and build up the family. Married couples should regard it as their proper mission to transmit human life and educate their children. Educate them, not just at the secular level, but at the religious level. Not just bring children into the world, but to raise them, love them, nurture them. In questions of regulating birth, the sons of the church, faithful to the principles, are forbidden to use methods disapproved by the teaching authority of the church in its interpretation of divine law. Paragraph 51. Well before Humanae Vitae, paragraph 51 talks about the immorality of artificial contraception. Why was it such a big surprise for some people then when Humanae Vitae came out by Pope Paul VI? Why is artificial contraception wrong? Because it divorces these two beautiful principles, love and life, unity and procreation, belong together within the sanctity of marriage. What does artificial contraception do? It divides that. It puts sex on a separate level from marriage. It divides the possibility of children from the unity of husband and wife. Now, the church has never said you have to have as many children as is physically possible to have. It's not seeing the woman, the mother, as a baby factory or machine. But it sees children as a gift from God, a gift to mom and dad, so that God will bless you with as many children as he knows you can handle. At the same time, we are allowed to use natural means to plan the family, natural family planning, using natural means, using reason and the natural rhythms within the body, using scientific methods that are available today to use natural methods to ensure that a family is spaced out enough that they can economically handle them. But at the same time, people are more worried about having a comfortable life, making sure there's two cars, two TVs, two VCRs. My father came from a family of seven, my mother from a family of eight, and they grew up during the Depression. They had virtually nothing, but they had love. Many kids today have no brothers and sisters. They have tons of things. They have TVs, computers, internet. They have satellite. They have kids get cars when they're in high school now. I had to be a deacon. I was 25 when I got my first car. There's kids at the local Catholic high school that drive better cars than the teachers because dad got them a Beamer for Christmas. This document reminds us that culture develops, it grows, it could also deteriorate. Therefore, Gaudium et Spes wants the people of the world to know that culture is not an end in itself. It has to conform itself to the gospel. It has to be conscious that people of every race and nation need to improve themselves to respect the dignity of the person, the sanctity of the family, and the individual right to do good, not to impose on people pre-structured ideas. We live now in a society where we live under this social engineering, where they want to sort of plan society, where they want to go to other parts of the world and tell them, you're having too many children, therefore we're going to give you these means, this birth control, so because you're having too many. In parts of the world, if you have a baby girl, she's killed. Parts of China, it's illegal to have so many, more than one child. And if you have a baby girl, it's worse. There are other parts of the world where it doesn't matter what gender the baby is, it's looked down upon. by the government, not by the culture. So culture has to conform itself to God, to the natural law, to revelation. We live too much in a world that wants to just let go and doesn't care. But there's still joy and hope. Why? Because the gospel still can and must be preached. This beautiful document tells us that whether it's economics, whether it's the defense of the nation, whether it's political rights, all things fall under the jurisdiction of God. And we have to depend on Him, but we can't just sit back and do nothing. The peoples of the world need to get together. This is why the Pope goes to the UN and says, look, you're here, you can do something. Recent moves to have the Holy See kicked out of the UN, why do they want the Holy See, the observer, out of the UN? Because they're afraid of the conscience they have. They're afraid that the Holy Father, who doesn't have a political vote in these things, but he's like the conscience of the world, says, look, everybody has a right to live. Everybody has a right to do good. And they don't want to hear that. But there is joy and hope because we have the potential. We have the potential, this document reminds us, the potential to improve things or the potential to make them worse. Well, we appreciate your attention and we know things can get better with your help. Please tune in again sometime. May God bless you and Mary keep you.